Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Trade has been an international issue as far back as the Silk Road, but it's been a while since it's grabbed so much attention in a presidential election.
We're getting killed in international trade right now.
The TPP is a horrible deal. It is a deal that is going to lead to nothing but trouble.
And when the Trans-Pacific Partnership was finally completed, and we could all see what was in it, I opposed it.
I have voted against every disastrous trade agreement coming down the pike.
We just heard Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, followed by Democratic candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, all weighing in on the effect they expect trade policy to have on the U.S. economy and everyday Americans. All this week, NPR stations around the country are participating in a coordinated conversation for a project called A Nation Engaged, speaking with expert guests and inviting listener comments on the very complex subject of trade in this election year. We're live tweeting our conversation today with the handle at KERA News, and we hope you'll join in with the hashtag NPR Trade. Our guest today, Ron Kirk. He served in the Obama cabinet as U.S. Trade Representative from 2009 to 2013, and as a former Mayor of Dallas and Texas Secretary of State, he is keenly aware of the importance of trade to our economic region. Currently, he's senior counsel at the law firm Gibson Dunn. Ambassador Kirk, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you so much for having me on, and thanks to you and NPR for what I think is a really, really important conversation that will affect not just the economic future of those of us in the Metroplex, but around Texas and around our country.
Well, yeah,
so thank you for the opportunity.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And I wanted to start with that because international trade is a big deal specifically for Texas in general and North Texas. North Texas has a multi-billion dollar annual export output. Can you talk, Ambassador, about the relationship between Texas jobs and international trade?
Well, you make an important point. No state benefits more from global trade and global commerce than the state of Texas. In Texas, we lead the country in exports, and no other states are close to. I mean, we export just shy of $300 billion of goods and products and services from the state of Texas. And those were based on numbers, just for your listeners' background, in 2014 when we had completed numbers. And that number is around a little under $30 billion, $28.7 billion in the North Texas community. And there are literally thousands of Texans who owe their livelihoods to the production and movement of goods to consumers around the world. So, and I understand that there are parts in our country that this is not the case, but I can tell you in Texas, we are spectacularly a beneficiary of our export policies.
How important specifically to the economy of Texas is our trade relationship with Mexico?
Well, the number one, you know, and as excited as I am, and I know I hope we're going to get an opportunity to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I promise,
because
yes.
I think it'll clear up a lot of mythology. But no state benefited more from NAFTA than the state of Texas. The reality is, as important as these emerging markets are around the world, and of all the things we'll talk about in this hour, I want your listeners to just hold on to one hard number. 95% of the world's consumers now live somewhere other than the United States. So the case for our being commercially engaged with the rest of the world should be a fairly self-evident one. We want to be the country that supplies the products, the goods, the food, the services that all these new consumers around the world are beginning to demand. As important as that is, our still largest trading partners are Mexico and Canada. We do roughly about 3.5. The last time I looked at these numbers, and I hadn't visited them in a while, but getting ready for your program, but we do roughly a little more than $3 billion every day of the year in trade between Mexico and Canada. And because of our proximity, because of the nature of our our communities, the border that we share, the movement of people and goods and services, and generally the strong relationships that we have maintained with Mexico and Texas over the last 40, 50 years, we benefit from that tremendously.
Okay, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been in the works for a very long time, something like 7 years. What are the primary stated goals of this agreement among the 12 Pacific Rim nations, including the United States, who are part of it?
Well, as you noted, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was born out of the collective ambition of the 21 member economies that make up something called APEC. It's the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperative, and it includes 20 countries plus the government of Taiwan that basically border the Asia-Pacific. And over the last 20 years, we have worked in a voluntary way to increase commerce among ourselves and reduce governmental barriers to doing that. About 10 to 15 years ago, the members collectively began to express a desire to have what was called an FTAP, a free trade agreement of the Asia-Pacific, recognizing that you had economies in wildly different states of economic progression, you know, from Vietnam, still so a communist state-owned economy, and China, all the way to the United States and Australia and New Zealand and other more advanced. A smaller subset of those countries came together to say, let us take a crack at it. And so when I came into office with President Obama in 2009 and assumed responsibility for our trade portfolio, I did so with one very direct mission from the president. One, and that was to do everything we could through our trade policy to help address the urgent need at that time to stop the economic hemorrhaging in our country, open new markets, create jobs. And we made a decision that we wanted to become a part of this effort for a couple of reasons. One, whether your listeners are a small business, you know, tech startup in Las Colinas or in the Design District in Dallas or sophisticated, you know, manufacturer in Frisco or other parts of North Texas, the one thing all business is founded on is location, meaning you want to be in the center of where there are potentially the largest number of customers. And the 12 countries that make up this Trans-Pacific Partnership represent some of the fastest growing economies in the world and where we believe the largest number of customers will be. And it will give the United States access to over 40% of global GDP. So one, it's an extraordinary economic opportunity for us. Secondly, and more critically, we had to make a hard decision that these countries were going to move forward whether the United States was a part of it or not. And either we would have the opportunity to be at the table and try to craft the rules of how commerce would take place among these countries and affect us, whether we were at the table or not. We thought it would be better to be there and learn from what we've learned from our trade mistakes in the past and have a trade agreement that reflected the ability and the realities of doing business today. And I think what we produced is an agreement that addresses so much of what you hear expressed in terms of concern against trade, or to some degree concerns people relate to what they believed either did or didn't happen in NAFTA. And we had an opportunity to address that. So this is an agreement that includes, for the first time, the strongest labor provisions of any trade agreement we've ever done. And for the first time, they're enforceable, just like the commercial provisions. It has the strongest provisions as it relates to extending environmental protections. The same thing for striking the appropriate balance between protecting our intellectual work product. We are a knowledge-based economy, and if we can't combat and enforce copyrights and patents and trademark and combat counterfeiting and piracy, then we're really in a perilous state. And this agreement, while it's not perfect, it goes a very long way toward giving American businesses and farmers and manufacturers that I had the privilege of speaking to during my 4 years, the one thing they all said, we're not afraid of trade, but what we want is a level playing field. We want a fair deal. We want an agreement that has enforceable labor rights so it doesn't you know, unintentionally incent businesses to move their manufacturing to lower wage countries. And so it's a very strong agreement. It puts us at the center of one of the fastest growing economic regions in the world. And as the president said, I think in a radio message on Monday, the reality is we're either going to shape the rules by which we participate in global commerce, or we're going to be shaped by them. And most likely, if we weren't at the table doing it, then China would have stepped into that void. And that wasn't our motivation for doing this, but it is an added benefit. The fact that we will now be playing on a field and under terms and conditions that we helped to dictate.
My guest is former U.S. Trade Representative, Mayor of Dallas, and Texas Secretary of State Ambassador Ron Kirk, currently Senior of Counsel at the law firm Gibson Dunn. We're talking about the importance of trade in the 2016 election season and beyond, live tweeting today's conversation at KERA News under the hashtag NPR Trade. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email think@kera.org or call 800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with Ambassador Ron Kirk.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Margie Evans, nationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former Mayor of Dallas, former Secretary of State, and former U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk, who is currently Senior of Counsel at the law firm Gibson Dunn. We're talking about the importance of trade in this 2016 election season. We're live tweeting at KERA News under the hashtag NPR Trade. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Ambassador Kirk, you have said that Americans have an attitude of hostility toward trade. Obviously, this is not every American, but in general, the public sentiment. What do you think accounts for public apprehension about the value of trade and what it might mean for jobs and businesses based here in the U.S.?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's politicians who all run for office and blame every factory that's closed and every job loss on trade. I mean, certainly, you know, we're in a period of time right now that certainly those on at least who think differently than I do feel that they just can't say anything good about the economy. But I would say one of the motivating factors for me to accept this portfolio under President Obama was his honesty and willingness to address and embrace the reality that, frankly, a lot of Americans do feel that they have not benefited from trade the way. And I know I'm not here to be a spokesman for the president, but Chris, I couldn't help but laugh when people attacked the president during the 2008 campaign as nothing more than a community organizer. And what they forgot, what his work was working to help displaced workers who'd lost their jobs in the manufacturing sector. And so rather than trying to dispute that or dispel that, what he said to me was, listen, Kirk, if you'd been raised in Detroit, as my wife was, or Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Maine or the Carolinas, you'd be angry about trade too. But the reality is we aren't going to put this genie back in the bottle. Because of advances in communications and transportation, the internet, we live in the most globally connected society ever. The United States made a wise decision years ago, frankly, in response to the Great Depression, to lower our tariffs so that we would make it cheaper for Americans to buy goods and services from around the world and put that judgment in their hands. And so what we set out to do was have a more honest conversation with the American public, the American consumer, who greatly benefits from trade. Every family in America enjoys about a 25% discount over what other families in the world pay for food because of trade. But one of our challenges is the value proposition is fairly well dispersed. We all love the fact we can buy clothes and electronics and computers and toys and food and get the best bargains and the best deals. But what we were concerned about is, where are the jobs? Are the jobs all going to Mexico or China? And is everybody else gaming the system? So one of the things we agreed was that we wouldn't go forward with any trade agreement if it didn't address those core concerns. And when we had an opportunity to look at the three agreements that we inherited, for example, with Panama, Colombia, and Korea, we made a commitment not to go forward with those until we addressed very specific concerns. In the case of Panama, as we've heard a lot now, Panama was branded a tax haven by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which the United States is a member. And we were very upfront with Panama and said, unless you fix this, you can't have a trade agreement with us. And Panama did that. And contrary to what one of the candidates has erroneously said, one, we enjoy a huge trade benefit with Panama. We run a surplus with Panama in everything from agriculture to manufactured goods to services. And Panama did put in place a new tax regime and a tax treaty they negotiated with Treasury before the trade agreement with Panama went into effect. So the notion that this trade agreement somehow fostered the behavior we're reading about now is untrue. In the case of Colombia, we were able to work with that administration to put in place some very strong protection for the rights of workers and union organizers who had routinely been murdered in that country, to address those concerns and land reforms, even though they weren't a part of the trade agreement before we went forward with that. In Korea, we got better market access. But the short answer is, rather than focusing on what Americans were angry about trade, we included them in the conversation. And the commitment I made is, I will bring you a trade agreement that looks like what you've said, that has strong labor provisions, strong environmental provisions, enforceable protection of our intellectual property rights, strong protection for America's workers and manufacturers and farmers. And that's what we've done. And when we have a conversation with Americans about that, about the fact that you want to be out there competing for this 95% of the consumers, but you want to do it on a level playing field, you want small businesses to have the opportunity to participate as well as big businesses, we see some of that anxiety, some of that hostility about trade begin to melt away. And I'm hopeful that once we get past the political decision and we can have a conversation about trade that's more fact-based about what it does and the benefits that can inure to our economy, that we will find the consensus in Congress, as we did previously, to go forward with this trade agreement that could have a huge impact on the way all of us live and purchase and do business in the future.
All right, quickly before we go to the phones here, if trade can't be materially good for every single American, if there are going to be maybe some jobs gained in this country and some jobs lost to trade, but they're likely not the same individuals affected, what can we do for Americans who might say, it's all well and good that I'm paying less for certain import goods than I would pay for those made in the U.S., but if I don't have the job I had before, it does very little for me? What do we do for the people who are, in fact, domestically, who are directly affected negatively by trade deals?
Well, we have to do a couple of things, Chris. And one of the tools that we put in place during NAFTA, it is one of the things that came out of NAFTA that labor was most responsible for negotiating, was something called trade adjustment assistance. And whether you had a trade agreement or not, the reality is, as we, you know, most of the jobs in manufacturing that have been lost, if you will talk to economists and get 10 economists in the room, they'll tell you about 2/3 of the jobs lost in manufacturing in this country have nothing to do with trade, but the fact that we are the most technologically advanced society in the world. And you know, enhancements, improvements in automation and computerization on the manufacturing floor, you know, have displaced workers. Now, we can't just say, oh, poor workers. What we've done through trade is put in place something called trade adjustment assistance. And we renewed that during the Obama administration, frankly, over the objections of some on the other floor. But it put in place a tool that recognized that when that worker lost his job, that worker was also probably the sole breadwinner in their family and was supporting that family's ability to own a home and put kids in school. And it's not that worker's fault that their job may have moved overseas or just been salted away. And so we put in place a tool to allow them to get retrained, hopefully in a career, in a field that they could then get gainful employment. But the reality is we live in a knowledge-based economy, and you can't see trade apart from the other efforts that we are investing in to rejuvenate our economy. And that's to make sure that we have the smartest and the best-trained workers in the world, and that we have the strongest protection for the genius that comes out of all of these new startups, the next tech developments, and you know, the next microprocessing fields. We have to do all of those things to make sure we maintain our competitive edge. But having trade adjustment assistance to be there right next to these trade agreements is critically important. And it's a great tool to give those workers an opportunity to get retrained, hopefully in a field that they can then be gainfully employed.
All right, let's jump on the phones now. First, we have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Mr. Ambassador. Thanks for your service to both our city and our country. You just talked about trade adjustment assistance and those sorts of things, and those are very important. But all those benefits and those efforts tend to go to middle and upper middle class folks. I mean, the labor folks who get displaced because of trade tend to be fairly well paid, et cetera. What's the argument for trade from the standpoint of the least of these? I mean, the hardcore poor, the folks in poverty, because what I see happening in our society is a growing gap between the very, very poor and everybody else. So why should somebody who is at the very bottom rungs of the socioeconomic ladder care about trade, and how do pro-trade people, why haven't they done a better job of making the case in general?
Well, there are not that many of us. Listen, Eddie, you've asked a very complex question, but it ones that goes at the core, I think, of some of the dissonance we're seeing in our current political debate. And Eddie, first of all, thank for your kind words, but you are correct. We've been paying lip service to this whole issue of so-called income inequality for 30 years. That's not a recent phenomenon. And I want to be careful, Eddie. I don't try to sell trade as a panacea for everything, but it can do a couple of things. And I hope you don't think I'm being unctuous, but hear me out. One, for those that you say at the bottom of the economic ladder, well, in one way they benefit from trade because these are the people that can't afford to pay 18%, 200% tariffs on the basic clothes and shoes they need. So to some degree, they, you know, on the consumptive end, those that are in the category that, Eddie, you described benefit disproportionately because more of their wages go for food and clothing and shelter. Now, one of the things that we tried to do in the Obama administration as we addressed the economic tsunami we inherited was accept certain realities. One was that figure I gave you of where the consumers are. But secondly, the reality in Dallas, in North Texas, in Texas, in America, one thing's true, and I learned it as mayor. Most of us work for companies that are 100 people or less. Not everybody gets the chance to work for Texas Instruments or Boeing or, you know, Parole Systems or even Southwest Airlines. And of those roughly 300,000 companies that export in the United States, about 90% of them are small businesses. And one of the things I embraced, Eddie, when I was mayor, and I told everyone, our next Fortune 500 company is here in Dallas. We don't know it because they're in a warehouse over in East Dallas. So they're in a warehouse in the design district, and it's four or five of them doing something we don't understand. And whatever we can do to nurture them and help them grow, when they're successful, they're not going to pick up and move to China or Mexico. So one of the things we've done is to try to bring more small businesses into our export world. We were talking about Texas at the top of the hour. There are about 20,000 companies in Texas that just export to the 12 countries we're talking about in TPP. 91% of those are small businesses. If we can help them grow their business, that's a great way to help workers who are coming into the marketplace because those small businesses tend to employ and hire locally, and when they grow at home.
Ambassador Ron Kirk is my guest, former U.S. Trade Representative, Mayor of Dallas, and Texas Secretary of State, currently Senior of Counsel at Gibson Dunn. We're talking about the importance of trade. If you would like to follow along as we live tweet at KERA News, the hashtag is NPR Trade.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with former U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Ron Kirk. He today is in the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., where coincidentally the Think team will be next week producing a live week of shows. We have guests including Senator John Cornyn. We have members of the North Texas Congressional Delegation. We have an expert on the lives of First Ladies. We have the head of the National Park Service. Should be a really interesting week of conversations. You can find us on Think in D.C. That's the hashtag to follow along our adventures. Back now to our conversation with Ambassador Ron Kirk. If you'd like to join it, you can send us a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We have, and the hashtag, of course, is NPR Trade. We have a tweet here from Larry who says, if TPP is so good for us, why the secrecy?
Well, there is no secrecy. I mean, I think that is... And Larry, I appreciate your tweet, but regrettably, for those who just are vehemently opposed to trade, they sort of trot out the same arguments all the time. You know, well, one, all the jobs will go elsewhere, and we're going to lose in manufacturing. Oh, they're negotiating secret. Well, the agreements are between 12 different economies. These are incredibly complex. And as I like to remind everyone, I'm not negotiating with my money. I'm negotiating with the lives of millions of workers and small businesses and businesses who are counting on us to go get them a better deal. And we're asking other countries to do the same. But this entire process is one of the most transparent the way we do trade in the United States of any. And Chris, I hope you bear with me a minute, but I want your listeners to understand how we do a trade agreement. Before we can do anything, we have to go to Congress and get their approval, because trade is one of those items that Congress retained the authority in the Constitution to negotiate all commercial treaties. Now, they effectively delegate that to the administration because no country is going to negotiate with 400 members of Congress. So in order for us to do any trade agreement, we go to Congress first and say, hey, we would like to enter a trade agreement with X number of countries. And we broadly tell them what our objectives are. And the goal of every trade agreement, basically, is to do away with all these tariffs and taxes that you as consumers pay. And we want to do them across all elements, typically manufactured goods, services, agriculture. And now we have these new areas that are important to us, cross-border data transfers and transparency and openness of markets and dealing with state-owned enterprises. So we tell Congress all of that. They give us pre-approval to do it. Then we enter those negotiations, and because trade covers so many areas, Congress mandates, and our office has up to 16 advisory commissions that help us develop our terms, and these are made up of businesses and farmers and ranchers and environmentalists and labor, because they know more about their business than we do, and they are all cleared advisors. Once we finish negotiating an agreement, and we have the agreement, then that agreement goes not only, and all the time we're negotiating, let me make this plain, our committees of jurisdiction, in the case of trade, the Senate Finance and House Appropriate Ways and Means Committee, have full insight to everything that we're doing. And that's the way you do business in a representative government. Once we get an agreement, then all of that agreement goes to the Congress, and it is also online now and has been online for 90 days so that any American can go online. They can go on the White House website or whatever and pull up this Trans-Pacific Partnership, and you can read every word of it.
So let me interrupt you for a moment. Excuse me. The president's fast-track negotiating authority does not mean that the president makes the deal and doesn't have to check back with Congress and get approval for the deal itself.
No, absolutely not. The Trade Promotion Authority, it used to be called Fast Track, Chris, and you know, every time a new party comes in, they say, we don't trust this president, so we come up with a new name. But what we know is fast-track trade promotion, you're absolutely right. The benefit it gives us, no other country wants to negotiate with us if they believe once we go through 5 years to do this, we're going to go to Congress and then they're going to amend it and beat us up and come back and say, here, give me this or give me that, because everything that we negotiate relates to everything else. And so it at least gives them the confidence that once we get a deal, it goes to Congress, it goes to our committees, the public can see it, everybody has 90 days to review it. But then if we have stayed within those parameters that Congress set for us, Congress has to approve the deal up or down. But it is online, every word of it. Any of your listeners can go on and read. And one thing I would not only encourage, but almost beg your listeners to do, go read this agreement, because you'll find out so much of what you hear of the criticism that's being raised about it is just not true. This is the most forward-thinking, the most progressive trade agreement that we've ever done. And if I hear one more person complaining about NAFTA, I would remind them NAFTA was 20 years ago. And trade agreements today are as different and advanced and progressive as the cars we drive versus the cars that we drove 20 years ago. And one sort of hidden secret of this agreement, for all of the people that tend to relate every trade criticism they have to NAFTA, we effectively have brought NAFTA into the 21st century because Mexico and Canada are part of the 12 countries that have signed this agreement. So all those complaints that you'll hear about people saying NAFTA didn't have a labor provision embedded in it or didn't have the right intellectual property rights or environmental, all of that is addressed by them becoming a part of this process and hopefully signing this agreement once it goes into effect.
For those talking about even enacting protectionist measures to discourage imports by the United States, are there any conditions under which our potential partners overseas would not retaliate with similarly protectionist provisions?
Well, there are two things. One, you're assured that they would retaliate. Secondly, as a member of the World Trade Organization, of which we are one of now 150-plus countries, we basically all make covenants to behave in a certain way, and we would be sued within the World Trade Organization. And third, more importantly, we know what happened the last time we did this. You all were very kind in your introduction of me. I'm decidedly a political, legal animal. But you do any study of the history of the Great Depression, and people will tell you that it was prolonged by at least 7 years by the fact that Congress did something they passed called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, that we retreated from global commerce. We put ridiculous tariffs on goods coming into this country, which cost families and businesses even more. And it extended, it created a reaction that resulted in protectionism all around the world, in which the world suffered. Look, you don't have to be a graduate of the Macomb School of Business or the School of Economics as SMU to understand. If you go into an airport and they've got a duty-free store, people flood in there because, oh, my God, I don't have to pay taxes on this stuff. Our pulling out of the TPP and becoming more insular means the rest of the world would go forward. This agreement reduces taxes on 18,000 goods and services that Texans and Americans need and buy every day. Every other country that's a part of this would enjoy the benefit of that. We would be paying a premium. We also wouldn't benefit from any of the reductions in tariffs in those countries. So everything that we in Texas are now shipping to these countries would be shipped at a premium. And you have to know, when you shop for a car, if one dealer offers you something and it's 2% cheaper and it's the same car, you're going to buy it from somewhere else. So protectionism is not the answer. America didn't become the most dominant economy of the world over the last half century. We did by being afraid. We did it by, first of all, creating the greatest system of public education in the world to make sure that every American had access to improve their lives through education and getting a good job. And we did it by being creative and working harder and fighting stronger for economic resources than any other country. And I'm confident from those businesses that I visited with over the last 3 years that, given a level playing field, which I think this Trans-Pacific Partnership provides us, we can compete and we can win. We shouldn't be afraid of global commerce. We have basically helped the rest of the world recover from World War II, recover from other conflicts in Asia. Now that those countries are coming of their own, it's our turn. And as counterintuitive as it may be to many of your listeners, our tariffs are already the lowest in the world. We have nothing to do but gain from other countries giving us terms that are going to be cheaper and easier for us to access their markets.
Before I let you go, will you turn your considerable lobbying skills to argue in favor of something called the Ronald Kirk Pedestrian Bridge?
Absolutely. Listen, when I was asked about it, I'll be gone. There are very few times, as you can tell from this interview, that I'm left speechless. And listen, I was really flattered I'd like to think I played a role in at least putting the dream of a Trinity River renewed corridor into play. And we did that with our council, but I also understand that every other bridge over there has been named for somebody that wrote a big old check. But that's not my place to go down to City Hall. I didn't undertake the effort to become the mayor of Dallas with the dream and hope that someday they would name something for me. I did it because I thought Dallas had spent too much time turning inward and focusing on our differences. And I thought we had a great franchise that needed new direction. And I got to tell you, when I look at those Calatrava bridges, I see the excitement and the development along the Trinity and the West Village and the University of North Texas and Oak Cliff, all that development in I-30, Mockingbird Station. I feel that's testament enough to me. And if the mayor and council tend to do so, I will even get off my rear end and start trying to go to yoga on Saturdays, but I'm not going to lobby for it.
Ron Kirk served as U.S. Trade Representative from 2009 to 2013. He is also a former mayor of Dallas and Texas Secretary of State, now Senior of Counsel at Gibson Dunn. Ambassador Kirk, thank you so much for making time for us.
Chris, thank you so much, and good luck with the pledge. And I will call back in. When our kids were younger, Matrice and I were just voracious consumers of everything that you do.
Thanks.